We have Shion Kim, who will tell us about Min-Min's quiver point mechanics of wall crossing.
Thank you. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about my recent work on return index and quantum mechanics. Unfortunately, as title indicates, I'm not going to talk anything related to about the modularity of moonshine thing, but I hope you could enjoy this talk because this is about the quantity which is very much related to the elliptic general of the two-dimensional theory. So this talk is going to be based on our recent work with Kentaro Hori and Hyojin Lee and also Hingyu. This is the brief summary of what I'm going to talk about today. First of all, I will give you a brief summary of the Kiber quantum mechanics and the relation between the wall crossing phenomena in four-dimensional n equals two theories. And using that, I'm going to tell you about some recent progress about the computing the written index of the one-dimensional gauge linear sigma model with at least two real supersymmetries. And using that result, I'm going to talk about some large length behavior and the mutation equivalent properties of the one-dimensional Kiber quantum mechanics. So I'm going to talk about the canonical Kibers, and for that Kiber, I'm going to give you some large length behavior of this MNN Kiber, and for Kiber, and then I'm going to go to Kiber with loops, and we'll tell you how the mutation. How the index transforms under the mutation I will define later. So this is a brief review of the relation between the Kiber quantum mechanics and wall crossing in four-dimensional n equals two theory, which was pioneered by the DNF and also DNF Moore at 2007. So for a given type 2F string theory, if you compactify it on the Calabi-Yau report, you can obtain four-dimensional n equals two supersymmetric theories. And the BPS particles living in that four-dimensional theory can be described by the three-brain wrapping some supersymmetric three cycles. And then the world volume theory of n such coincident BPS particles will be described by one-dimensional n equals four U1 gauge multiplet. And since Calabi-Yau manifold has natural symplectic structure, and that can be interpreted in four-dimensional senses of some electromagnetic Schrödinger products, which I will deal with this bracket. And if there is K such interaction, we have K n equal 4 bifundamental hypermultiply, which connects to a vector multiply. So this is the most simplest example. If we have two BPS particles in the four-dimensional sense, if you solve some BPS equations, you will get, if some conditions are met, you will get some bound state between these two particles, which is, again, another BPS state. So that formulation of BPS states is encoded in this simple Kiber diagram. It's U1 gauge node, which is connected by K by fundamental hypermultiply. So this is the contents of the Kiber quantum mechanics. For each vector multiplet, we have this kind of component, and this is the five fundamental Kyler field. Most importantly, we have SUL times U1 R global. Yes?
What did you call it, hypermultiplet?
Sorry?
What did you call it,
hypermultiplet? The Kyler multiplet, sorry. Kyler multiplet in one-dimensional theory, one-dimensional sense. It's just a dimensional reduction from the two-dimensional GLSM. So you can start with just a dimensional reduction from the two-dimensional GLSM. You are all familiar with. And this SU2L global symmetry rotates this real scalar field X1, 2, 3, which can be thought of as some angular momentum in the three spatial directions. So this the quantum number I will call with J and I. And this theory depends on real parameter, Fi parameter theta, which comes in action with this particular contribution. So the wall crossing is most naturally explained in so-called Coulomb picture. In Coulomb picture, when the distance between two particles are large enough, you can integrate over the Kyler multiplet there, and you end up with this effective potential at the Coulomb branch. So this is a figure of that effective potential. And you will see that at the minimum of that effective potential, you will get some bound state. It's described before, which I described before. And when zeta goes smaller and goes smaller, it becomes, when zeta goes to zero and negative, this effective potential develops some flat direction, and this bound state will become non-renormalizable, and you are going to lose one bound state from your one BPS state from your BPS spectrum. So this is how you can see the work-hosting phenomena in this Kuiper quantum mechanics in the Coulomb picture. So the counting of the index in the Coulomb branch is very well established program in the by the work of this Manchot, Piolin, and Sen. And as you see in the previous slide, this Coulomb branch analysis naturally counts the BPS states which has some multi-centered nature. So that BPS state which has a multi-centered nature has all set of bound, BPS bound state when Kuiper does not have any non-trivial loop. But if you have non-trivial loop, it actually misses a lot of BPS states. So for example, if you see this particular type of Kuiper, you can see that there are actually three chambers in the zeta space. And for each chamber, you get this kind of hot diamond. And since Coulomb branch analysis only counts the states which has a multi-centered nature, it counts on only particular middle part where it's non-trivially transforms under the SU2 third component. So you actually miss this 26 states from this kind of analysis. So one of the motivation is to try to find the index formula which properly incorporate all the states in there. Actually, this 26 states, which is actually invariant under this work crossing, is what we call as a Kuiper invariance, and it has several properties. First of all, it appears when Kuiper has non-trivial loop, as I told you before, and it is invariant under the work crossing, as you can see. And most importantly, this is a singlet under SU2L, and if you increase this number of intersection number, this number appears in the horizontal middle line, exponentially grows.
What is the singlet under SU2L? Is that no exotics?
No. That no exotics is corresponds to singlet under U1R.
Uh-huh.
So this is, it means that it doesn't transform under the, it doesn't have multi-centered nature. Uh-huh. It is a single-centered index. So this property implies that these states actually corresponds to some microstates of single-centered black hole of single-centered black hole of four-dimensional n equals to supergravity. And yeah, actually, that's the most natural candidate of the state which corresponds to such black hole states in four-dimensional n equal to supergravity. And one of the motivation is that to find some systematic procedure of counting BPS index, which include all such BPS states. So one of the natural things you can think of is they do the direct path integral of such quantum mechanics, which will calculate the index, which is given by this expression where J3 is the SU2 angular momentum, and I is the U1R symmetry of the one-dimensional Kuiper quantum mechanics. And as you all know, this quantity is invariant under the small deformation, and it also has integer valued if the target manifold is sufficiently good. But this property fails when there is some any non-compact direction at the moduli space or somewhere. So this is the general figure of the chamber space of in the zeta space of general U1 theory. And at what happens is that at this chamber boundary, you get some Coulomb branch, which is non-compact. And there is no reason that if you go from here to here, this quantity should be preserved. So you actually, the index defined here is a well-defined integer, and here you have a well-defined integer, and there's no reason that this integer and this integer should be same. And this is how we how we will see the recursion phenomena in one-dimensional gauge linear sigma model. So we can actually do the, this test integral by the localization. When the gauge coupling goes to zero, the test integral localizes to the some Cartan zero mode integral, which we are left with the integral over some component of the vector multiplet. And this is the one loop determinant we get from that. So as you see, from vector multiplet, we get this. From the Cartan multiplet, we get that.
This is the Cartan of the gauge group of the nodes?
Yes, gauge group of the node Cartan. Yeah, you are the third component of the scalar and the zero. So as you see, there are a bunch of pores, which is defined by the charges of the chiral multiplet, and also the comes from the vector multiplet here. So the integral, the after the localization, integral is given by this expression. And there is actually a lot of gauge in a zero mode there, which you should be careful. And after taking care of a very, taking care of this gauge no zero mode integral as well as this D integral, which is the most important part of this work, you will actually end up with some residue integral over selected pores, which select whose selection procedure is given by so-called Jeffrey Cohen residue integral. So the Jeffrey Cohen residue integral has important parameter eta, which a priori doesn't have has nothing to do with any physical parameters. But this is what defines the which singularity we should integrate over. And for two-dimensional, this is where actually the difference between 2D elliptic genera and one-dimensional quantum mechanics comes in. When the eta equals positive, for example, for U1 case, the Sabellian case, the 2D elliptic genera, this Jeffrey-Cohen residue formula selects the pore which has a positive charge under that U1 gauge group, which picks these two particular pores. And when eta is negative, that chamber, you will select this pore. So the same applies for one-dimensional case, but for two-dimensional case, since the integral domain is compact, whether you pick this pore or this pore does not actually change its answer. But in one-dimensional case, this pore integral over this pore or this pore actually can change because of this pore at infinite direction, which actually how the work crossing phenomena comes in. And this is matches with the Coulomb branch discussion I told you before. So in one dimensional case, actually you can, if you carefully do that D integral, you can show that this eta parameter is identified by this FI parameter in the one-dimensional Kibler quantum mechanics, which governs the recursing phenomena. So this is the rule, the precise rule of the Jeffrey Cohen residue for singularities where R, exactly how R a hyperplane meets, which means which corresponds to some simple pore in the.
So R is the rank of the
group? Yeah, R is the rank of the total group.
And can you explain what cone of Q is?
Cone of the Q is a, actually Q comes in this expression.
Yes.
So rank codimension R singularity is given by some some R number of chiral multiplet point chiral multiplet charges. And that if eta is in the positive span of that Q, you should pick that pore.
I'm not understanding. Where's eta? What's eta?
Eta is actually some for one dimensional case.
Eta is the FI.
Yeah, eta is identified as FI constant. Okay. Okay, so any questions? Okay, so this is the formula for the one-dimensional gauge linear sigma model, which can be applied for theory with at least two real supersymmetries. So this is one example, one most simplest example. If you consider some cubic Calabi-Yau threefold embedded in CP4, for fi larger than zero, you get this famous Hodge diamond. And for fi negative, where you get some Landau-Ginzburg phase, you will lose this vertical states as you cross the wall. This is one example of the wall crossing. Okay. So, and actually, there are a lot of applications of this the index of the Kibler quantum mechanics, but today I'm going to focus on some application to the states with DPS states of the four-dimensional n equals two theory. First of all, I want to talk about some scaling behavior of the Kibler quantum mechanics. For Kibler invariants, I talked at the very beginning. Since we expect that it counts the black hole degeneracy in supergravity, we expect that that grows like n squared. This is our first motivation to see the scaling behavior, but unfortunately, we haven't succeeded this so far. But instead, as a first step, I'm going to address how.
I mean, that depends. I mean, if the quiver is counting BPS states in a field theory, I would really hope we don't see a log of omega go like n squared, right?
Yes, right. But for supergravity result,
if the quiver corresponds to supergravity.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's not a general, it depends on the quiver.
Okay, yes. Of course. Yes, and as our first step, I'm going to discuss about the scaling behavior of the Coulomb-like quiver, which actually does the work cross. And so I'm going to talk about the scaling behavior of the multicentered states. And the most interesting properties of the PS states of four-dimensional n equals two theory is a mutation equivalence. It transforms gamma like this, this left mutation, this right mutation. And the physical interpretation of this left and right mutation is given by this diagram. So this is the central charge plane, and this arrows denote the stable BPS states in that chamber. And this red line distinguishes or defines this particle and antiparticles in that quiver. And this mutation definition corresponds to the right mutation corresponds to rotate this head plane in a counterclockwise way, and the representation corresponds to rotate this head frame in the clockwise way. So this is the physical picture of this mutation equivalence. And since this is just a basis change of charge vectors, we expect them some non-trivial equivalence between some moduli space of two different looking quivers that we are going to examine for some subset of quivers. And also we could ask that how does quiver invariant transforms under the such mutation invariance. So first of all, I'd like to start with the canonical quiver, which describes the bound states of this charge, this intersection number K. And this canonical quiver exhibits the most simplest work crossing phenomena in the sense that there is a one independent parameter zeta, and along that zeta, when zeta is larger than zero, the chambers are distinguished by the sign of zeta, and when zeta smaller than zero, actually all state disappears. And when m and n are co-prime, it is known that the moduli space of Kibler is M and N are mutually coprime, the moduli space of this quiver is actually compact, and you can actually calculate the dimension of the moduli space, which is given in this formula. The equivalent index of this quiver is briefly wrote down by the Reinecke 2003, but it's kind of hard to investigate the large N behavior because it is given by some of very particular partition of the sum of over the partition of various components. So it's kind of hard to investigate the large N behavior. So let's apply our technique we developed so far. So with the index formula for this conical quiver is given by this sort of expression, where eta is given by this physical DFI parameter. So when k equals 1, you can actually show from this expression that the MN, for general MNN, most of the case index is equal to 0, except that MNN are 1, you get 1, which is most simplest or cosmic phenomena I showed you at the very beginning. And this can be inferred from just counting the number of the poor n zeros. And for k equal 1 case, you can actually show that the number of pores are not enough to calculate the Lenkhar-Rajedy integral. And k equal 2, you can also show that the index vanishes except for these three cases. And you can easily see that these two cases correspond to the hypermultiplet of the four-dimensional n equals 2 theory. And this correctly produces the character for the GPS vector multiplet in for the n equals 2 theory. And actually, k equals 3 is a sort of watershed that number of pores grows exponentially this rank. So you can very easily see from the previous formula that there are a lot of degenerate as well as non-degenerate point appears. So the calculation becomes very complicated, and this appears at this kind of quiver appears at some point of the moduli space of four-dimensional SUK theory with some larger length, which is shown by this paper. And there are actually a class of quiver that you can actually track all these pores which contributes. This is the quiver which is given in this left figure. And for such set of quiver, you can actually show that no non-degenerate point appears, only the no degenerate point appears, only the non-degenerate point contributes to the Witten index. And for each of the pore, this is the contribution of the Jeffrey Cohen residue. And where these FNGs are some combination of the flavor fugacities. And what is interesting is that in the G goes to zero limit, which is exactly the Witten index limit, this all cancels out and it contributes one to the Witten index. So actually the problem reduced down to counting number of contributing pores, which satisfies the Jeffrey Cohen condition, which you can do recursively by increasing D. And it's interesting that by the mutation equivalence, this quiver is mapped to this simpler looking quiver, whose index
is. So what's
is
the answer? So omega is just one?
Oh, no. This is for given four, this is one.
Yes. So what's the answer? Are you going to say?
Yeah, I'm going to say in the next slide. So actually, the contribution. The closed formula for the index of this kind of quiver is well known, and we are going to reproduce that. So actually, such iterative counting procedure of the pores which passes the Jeffrey Cohen condition can be neatly summarized in the following recurrent relation, where F is the number of pore contributes which satisfies the Jeffrey Cohen condition, which has n plus 1 node. And this is represented by some lower number of Fn. And actually, this is very well-known problem in the combinatorics problem to count the number of graphs which satisfy certain condition. And if you define some generating function which is given by this, there exists some auxiliary parameter, and it satisfies some algebraic equation. That this Lycurgus relation satisfies this interesting algebraic equation. And the by so-called Lagrangian-Burton theorem, you can extract the coefficient of Fk, which satisfies whose generating function satisfies this algebraic equation. This is given by this closed form.
What's the relationship between the Fkms and the omega?
Fk and omega for.
Right. So you wrote these Fkms, and they said the generating function for the Fkn satisfies a nice algebraic equation.
Okay.
How is that related? How are the Fkms related to omega?
The omega is given by Fk. Actually, the real generating function is the Fk of x times k divided by. By one of this is some overall coefficient, and this is given by the omega. This is the real generating function, and the it is related to the omega of the.
Omega is not a function of x.
It's omega is function of x.
Oh, that's a generating function.
Yeah, generating function for omega.
Multiplicative or additive?
This is just given by this expression.
I see. Additive.
Yeah.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, so this is the omega b. Mm-hmm. Omega b, yeah. Nice one. So this is the closed expression for number of poles contributing. And you can actually extract the large rank behavior. This is given by the exponentially large. And as was explained in this interesting paper, this scaling behavior of the this linear scaling behavior of the entropy is not very typical scaling behavior of the theory, which has some conformal fixed point. And the because the dimensional analysis implies some bound on the entropy, which is faster than this linear divergence. And they beautifully explained this phenomena by solving some Dnef Kibler quantum mechanics equation, in which I showed you at the very beginning, that this implies that actually the bound states of the BPS states become, the size of the bound state become very large, which grows as actually grows with B, and it actually corrects this bound with this expression, which actually agrees with our formula here. So this is one thing we could do with this separate common thing. And the second thing I want to address is the mutation equivalence of the Kibler quantum mechanics. So this is something like one-dimensional cyborg-like duality, which can be thought of as some closed algebra properties of four-dimensional n equals two theory. So these are definitions. The first two things are left and right mutation, where Bik is the intersection number between ith node and kth node. And Bij can be the transformation property of the Bij can be extracted from this relation, which is given by this. And you can also define some transformation property of the rank vector, which is given by this. However, this is not unique choice, but if you want to preserve the total length, total charge gamma, which is the sum of ni and gamma I, this is the unique choice of the transformation of the rank vector of the Kibler quantum mechanics. So I'm going to examine the invariance under this Kibler quantum mechanics of under this transformation rule. And actually, the FI parameter is this, since the FI parameter is also given by the function of gamma, it should transform samely as the transformation of the gamma I. So this is that transformation rule. And since this defines the chamber of the Kibler, the mutation can be thought of as which maps chamber to chamber, rather than the Kibler to Kibler. So I'd like to emphasize that the unlike cyborg duality in higher dimensions, there exists actually choice of the left and right mutation map. And for given points of the moduli space, there is a there is unique choice of node which can mutate. So this is some difference between the cyber duality in higher dimension. So I'm going to test some.
Sorry, I didn't catch it. What's the difference from the cyber duality of higher dimension?
Cyber duality in higher dimension. Okay, the cyber duality in higher dimension, there is no choice of the no choice of the left or right mutation.
You mean there's no distinction?
No distinction between left and right mutation. In four-dimensional, the anomaly cancellation condition fixes the left and right mutation to be same. And the for three-dimensional case and two-dimensional case, I guess some, I guess one of the choice is only allowed.
So Daniel Park et al. Had some similar story about FI parameters in, I think, in 2.2 theories.
Yes, yes.
In
but
one of those dimensions.
Yeah, that is very different.
They, they have a distinction between left and right or not?
For that case, only one of the choice is allowed.
I see.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the difference between the higher dimensional cyborg duality, and I'm going to test it with the some non-abelian qubit, which has an untrivial loop, which is this N11 type of qubit. So I picked this particular type of qubit because although it there is some very complicated degenerate port appearing in this type of qubit, I can track all the residue structure of this qubit. And also we can argue that the chamber structure of this sort of qubit is given by this diagram. And we have four distinct physical chambers which describes this workhorsing of this qubit. So under the right mutation, we expect that some chamber of this type of qubit is mapped to some chamber of this qubit. By the way, I'm mutating this most top node. And if you do the right left mutation, it will be mapped to some chamber of this type of qubit. So the before proof that we are going to examine some proper prototype of the left and right mutation of the qubit quantum mechanics, which is given by one-dimensional supersymmetric QCD. So for this kind of qubit, which has two flavor nodes, there are one FI parameter which is distinguished to two chambers. And at one chamber, the index is given by this expression. And you can manage this expression to show that this is actually equivalent to this expression, which is nothing but the index of the some left chamber of this type of qubit. And you can see similarly for zeta equals negative, the index maps to the right chamber of this type of qubit. And we are going to use that relation to prove some more general qubit quantum mechanics mutation. So this is how we prove the duality. For this N11 qubit, we first flavorize this node. By flavorizing, we mean that factoring out the contribution which includes the variables in this node, and then we can apply this identity which I showed in the previous slide. And using this by gauging this node again, we get this type of qubit. So we can actually show the identity between these two qubit, which maps them particular chamber to chamber. So this was the this is the result. We could show that this distinguishes which node we can mutate. For 2 and 3 qubit, we can actually show that we can only right mutate the third node. And for 1 and 4 chamber, we can only left mutate the third chamber, a third node. And we can show that actually this map to 2, 3 chamber maps to 1, 4 chamber of the right mutated qubit. And 1, 4 chamber is mapped to 2, 3 chamber of the left mutated qubit. So this is one check. So, and if you do the assumption that superpotential is generic and there's no one cycle, which looks like this, and two cycles, which looks like this. Actually, this is very important assumption. And if you do this assumption for this middle keyboard, the mutation map is very well defined for even for keyboard with loops and can be done indefinitely this side or this side. So this is what we checked. And I'm going to explain you the how the mutation, what is the right mutation map for keyboard invariance, which I told you before, which appears as this vertical middle part, the horizontal middle part of the Hodge diamond. What is shown by the MPS, Mantel-Piolin and Sen, is that the general index of the keyboard quantum mechanics is given by this particular expression, where the sum is taken over all possible partitions of the charge vectors. So if you have 3-1-1 charge keyboard, it can be decomposed into some of the very different keyboard quantum mechanics, which has 3-1-1 and 2-1-1 and 1-1-1 and 2 keyboard. So the sum is taken over all such possible partitions. And for each partition, for each component, you associate something called keyboard invariant, which I told you before. And the index, the total index is given by sum over all such partitions where at each component you do the Coulomb branch analysis of this keyboard invariant. And this effectively thought of as one node of the disk keyboard and one node. So this is the MPS formula they gave at 2012. And since we know this left-hand side using this rigid integral formula, and this also this Coulomb branch formula is very well established, we can extract the keyboard invariant part. Or since keyboard invariant, the disk keyboard is sub-keyboard of infinitely many keyboards, so we can always single out that invariant part. And we checked how does that keyboard invariant transforms under the mutation. So actually, what I told you before is that the transformation properties of NI is not unique, but the mutation transformation I defined before is under the assumption that the total charge gamma is invariant. But you can naturally think of it as think of another transformation rule that gamma also transforms like the elementary node, which looks like the right transformation rule for keyboard invariant. This plays a role of the elementary law of each component. And interestingly, these two keyboard mutation rules are summarized into this one relation, where here we have the left mutation and right mutation becomes equivalent. And yes, this is more like the higher dimensional cyborg duality. And under this transformation, new transformation rule, we have checked that this keyboard invariant is invariant under this mutation type, and which maps a keyboard to keyboard rather than a chamber to chamber. So this is the final result. Yeah, and this is a summary of what I thought. Okay, I'll stop here.
Questions? So there are two ways of generating functions for the BPSD degeneracies of a quiver. One is the kind of additive generating function you wrote, and another, you must know, is also a kind of multiplicative one, where you would take the product of 1 minus z to the n and raise it to the power of omega n times some primitive vector gamma.
Okay.
Right. And if you do the latter, then if you look at the Kronecker quiver with dimension vector 1, multiples of 1, 1, the primitive vector is 1, comma 1, dimension 1 in each node, then that satisfies an interesting algebraic equation, right? P equals 1 plus zp to the k minus 1 squared, k arrows. Now you seem to get an algebraic equation, not quite for omega, but for this f of x.
Yes.
The dimension vector there was what? D, the primitive one was d, d minus one, if I remember.
Yes, the dimension vector was, actually this was calculation for more simpler type, more d and minus one, d plus one, I guess. But okay. This is mutation equivalent.
That's to m? I thought you had k.
Okay.
What's m?
K.
Okay, and so does the generating function, the additive, let's call those the additive and the multiplicative generating functions for omega. So does the additive generating function for omega satisfy some nice algebraic equation? It probably does, because f is
yes.
K.
Yes.
Right. Now, from spectral networks, you can see that these multiplicative generating functions should satisfy some system of algebraic equations, but writing them down is very difficult.
Okay.
Except when the primitive vector is 1, 1.
Okay.
Okay, so I think Tom Manyera has managed to do it for some other primitive vectors in the chronic quiver. But right, but it's very, I mean, something like a rank 39 polynomial equation. It's really impressive. But can you see, using this formula with the Jeffrey Kirwan residue, how to write down algebraic equations for these kinds of generating functions for omega?
You mean the multiplicative?
No, the additive. The additive seems like a better one.
Okay.
I just so Manyera, I think, had something like a d d minus one,
mm-hmm.
And he had some very fearsome looking algebraic equations. So I'm impressed that in your case you have some rather simpler algebraic equations. It seemed.
Yes.
From what you said. So the question is for general primitive mm-hmm. vector. Could you write down some algebraic equations to generate such that these generating functions satisfy them?
Yes, for general.
Those are very useful for looking at asymptotics.
Yeah, for general rank vector, actually the degenerate force, which is higher order force, comes into the calculation.
Yeah.
Actually, though, we are not sure that even if even for that case, the result of residue integral is 4 is 1 or not. That we are not sure.
Okay, so you don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. For non-primitive case, we actually the vector multiplier four starts to come in, so
yes.
It becomes very complicated expression.
Okay.
So I'm
so
not sure.
Okay, yeah. So you don't know. I mean,
I don't. Yeah.
But from spectral networks, sort of there's a general mm-hmm. prediction
mm-hmm.
that if you make some kind of multiplicative
okay.
generating function,
okay.
it should satisfy an algebraic equation. And then
okay.
experimentally,
mm-hmm.
if you do not just the BPS degeneracies, but the protected spin character, where you include the spin information.
Okay.
So now you have a generating function of two things, x and y.
Okay.
That, at least for the primitive vector 1, 1, seems to satisfy some kind of functional equation. And there's no understanding of that.
Okay.
So
okay.
if that, you know, if you could explain that using these alternative formulas, either MPS or this Jeffrey Kirwan type
mm-hmm.
formula, that would be really nice.
Okay, thank you very much.
Are there other questions? All right, let's thank the speaker again.